Today we're joined by Steve Baker. He's an independent journalist for The Blaze, and he's ran afoul of the law somehow. Tell me about this, Steve.
How did I run afoul of the law? Well, you know, I guess because I followed the story where the story went. And a couple of aspects to that is that in order to capture the story, I allegedly entered a restricted area. Of course, 60 other journalists also went through broken windows and open doors, and they also followed the story where the story went, but they submitted their stories to the right publications or media sources, and I didn't.
Welcome to Liberty Lockdown. Please scan your barcode. Your liberty ain't gone, but yeah, it's on hold. Where did it come from and where did it go?
So therefore, I ran afoul of the law. And that's really that's what it boils down to. It's a selective prosecution case.
That's amazing. Do you think it's because it was a conservative outlet that you were reporting for?
Well, at the time I was reporting for myself. I was not working for The Blaze at that time. I was, I had my own blog, my own podcast, doing my own thing. And obviously the government and others are going to try to define that as a position in which I was not credentialed. I was not working for a legitimate news source. And therefore I was an active participant in the mob, as they have described other independent journalists who have been prosecuted for doing the exact same thing that I did, just as peacefully, just as nonviolently, just as professionally as I did. And yet they have been prosecuted as well. I'm not the only one.
Just to clarify, did you do anything violent? Did you violate anybody's bodily autonomy?
No, and no such charges even made by the government. So
yeah, well, you know, I know. I just want to make sure the audience understands this is a strict trespassing. And are they challenged? So I assume they have to be challenging the nature of your existence on that day. Are they saying that you were not a journalist because you were not working for anybody else?
They're certainly going to make that case. They're going to have a hard time doing so, which we can get into in some depth if you'd like to. But that, you know, as with all of these January 6th charges, the four misdemeanors that I'm charged with includes abusive language, includes the picketing and parading charges, neither which of true. They always overcharge. They always charge individuals with crimes that they did not commit because they hope to get you to be frightened into a quick and easy plea deal to take the easy way out.
Right.
But the DOJ does that as a matter of course anyway, even with non-January 6 prosecutions. That's just their modus operandi, is to overcharge, scare you into a quick plea deal. They get their notch in the gun belt. They get their points towards their ascension inside the Department of Justice, and they move on to the next case. And we're not going to let them get by with that this easily. They're going to have to work for this one. And then we're going to obviously prove that three of those charges are complete absurdities, nonsense. And then as it relates to the actual glorified trespassing charge, you know, the entering and remaining into a restricted space, it's like, fine. Go ahead, charge me with that. But if you're going to do that, you have to charge the other 60 journalists who also entered into a restrictive space, because the law says it doesn't matter how many credentials you have hanging around your neck on your lanyard. It doesn't matter if it says New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, NPR, or whatever. Any journalist, this is journalism 101. If they went to journalism school, they know they cannot enter a restricted space without express permission by law enforcement. And that's just the rules. That is the way it is. So if they are going to charge me and not charge them, then it is an open and shut case of selective prosecution for political purposes.
Yeah. Well, it screams that to me, but it doesn't, I just hope that the defense in court will stand in that way, because it's vitally important that it be applied equally. Otherwise, justice is no longer blind, and it is, in fact, partisan in nature, and it appears that it probably is.
Well, it is, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. No, I I shouldn't say it appears. It is 100%. Good point. So what was the... I mean, first off, I watched your interview with Kyle Serafin from yesterday, and mm-hmm. for those that want your whole life story, I would highly recommend that one. It is very interesting. But I think that the thing I took away from it that I didn't know and I thought was interesting is that You, in fact, voted for the Libertarian in 2016. So you were not even a Trump supporter. You did vote for Trump in 2020.
Yeah.
After being able to assess who he was in power. Do you think that Trump has done enough for people like you?
No, I don't. I am quite disappointed in that for a lot of reasons. The first and most important thing is, and I don't mind disclosing it here, I've actually worked with the Trump team, not only his campaign, but also his legal team on some of these issues that he's up against, because I know some things from my own investigative journalist work that they needed access to in order to help build their case in his own DC trial, January 6th related trial that he's facing. So I've worked with his investigators on that side. I've also been in touch for quite some time with his own campaign. And one of the messages that I took his campaign was that he was making a gigantic political error by not funding in some manner these January 6th cases and supporting the families. Now, I'm not suggesting by any means that he needs to come out of pocket with that, but I believe, and I convinced some people very high up in his campaign that if he did a series of summer rallies, stadium shows, whatever, that he could have raised $250 million to offset, pay for these legal expenses and put these people on the same, playing ground against the government, which has unlimited resources in their incredible, audiovisual psyops that they run on the DC media in these trials, which I've covered several of them. And then also support these families who have lost everything or are losing everything as a result of these unwarranted prosecutions. And I'm not talking about the people that did, violence and the people that lost their shit that day and threw themselves into battle for whatever reason, whether they were there for nefarious purposes or they just got caught up in the mob mentality, whatever the case may be. But the vast majority of these people did not do anything other than the accidental tourism, that is, as I like to call it. They saw the doors were open. They saw the police had stood down. They were standing beside or off to the side. They were talking on their phones. They were chatting with their, probably, texting their wives and letting them know that I'm okay, honey. And then hundreds of people were flowing into the Capitol, just as hundreds of people flowed into the Capitol before I walked through an open door and caught on my own camera law enforcement officers off to the side doing absolutely nothing, providing no resistance, not shouting, yelling, or warning people to stay out or go away. And so when I entered through the door, I just assumed that it was open game is a wrong way to say it, but I was following the story from first thing that morning to wherever the story went. And the story eventually went into the Capitol. And as a journalist, that's where I followed the story, as did the fifth person through the broken window, who was with the New York Times, and as I've clearly pointed out, and I'm going to make this case, if they don't allow me to present this in court, I'm going to try this in the court of public opinion long before we get to court. And I'm going to make sure America knows that New York Times press badge did not give him the legal permission to go through a broken window.
Right.
Charge him for the same crime that you have charged me, or don't charge any of us.
Yeah. No, I think it has to be that way. If it's not that way, this isn't America. it's just the end. Well, the reason I asked about whether or not Trump has done enough for the folks like you is, I've had Jacob Chansley on the show. I've also had Adam, the lectern guy, on the show. And, they have differences of opinion on this. But some people, and I've theorized this myself, that perhaps Trump being very vocal in the defense of folks like you would, in fact, make the situation worse, given that the entire judicial system and the entire political apparatus, the entire media apparatus has been so ramped up against him and his supporters. And in some ways you're not even really a supporter of his. So maybe it makes the situation worse, but I do agree, it's his like not you necessarily, but it's his people broadly that were there on that day. Yeah. And he is kind of not said much, kind of not done much on their behalf. So I'm torn as like, where do you fall on the counter argument that him speaking out on your behalf may in fact make the situation worse.
Well, he is speaking out against government corruption. He's speaking out regularly, daily about the weaponized agencies. He has gone on record as saying, "I am going to be your retribution." I mean, that's a pretty powerful statement right there. I'm going to be your retribution. In other words, what they have done to you, I'm going to get them back for that. Okay. Okay. So now, getting more specific about that, I don't see any harm in him politically. And in fact, his campaign agreed with me when I spoke to them about this a year and a half ago. I said, do a series. I don't know how many it'll take. Might take one, might take three actual rallies of the types of events that he fills up, you know, stadiums or theaters arenas.
Auditorium.
Yeah. And do a fundraising specifically and bring some of the individuals on stage that are the most abused. And I'm not talking about bringing people that, you know, swung baseball bats at police. I'm not talking about them at all. I'm talking about bringing up people who have genuinely had their rights abused, who generally have not been given the due process afforded them by the Bill of Rights and by our laws, and bring them up as examples, and then bring up the examples of those who have lost everything as a result of this, for walking inside the Capitol for 10 minutes and taking a couple of selfies and then leaving the building. And that's all they did. They participated in no violence whatsoever, but then they got SWAT raided for misdemeanors by a dozen or 15 or 25 FBI agents at their homes with the red dots on their forehead and on their wife's chest and on their children at 6:30 in the morning, and bring these cases before the American people and show them that not only were they subjected for misdemeanor offenses, nonviolent misdemeanor offenses, to these types of overaggressive police raids at their homes, when all they had to do was just call them in and call them in for a voluntary sit down, like they did with me, because they did do that with me. And then show what the other ramifications that happened in their lives. The fact that they both, you know, husband and wife that walked through and took a couple of selfies, they both got home and they were fired from their jobs. They were kicked out of their church. They were made pariahs in their community and in their neighborhoods. And then because they couldn't work, they lost their homes. They had their bank accounts taken away from them.
Wow.
All of these things that happened to them, and the only crime that they committed was being in the wrong place at the wrong time that day without the knowledge. I'll tell you, this is a really interesting point, is that, you know, that there were thousands of people who were actually at the Capitol that day that were not even aware that violence had taken place until they got in their cars and started driving home and started hearing and seeing reports about it on social media. It
makes sense to me. Yeah.
It's because of the enormity of the event, the enormity of the crowd meant you could be as little as 50 feet away. And because of the way the staircases were, the terracing on one side, you could be 15 feet away on the east side, standing on the steps, singing the national anthem, thinking that this is the greatest day of your life.
Right.
We have made our voices heard. The people inside that building can hear me singing the national anthem and not know that 15 feet away, that two cops were getting the shit kicked out of them up there guarding that Columbus door.
Right.
You could have no idea that that was happening.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I've been to big rallies and things like that. In fact, I did one on the Lincoln Memorial steps, and it's true. Like, once you have an immense amount of people, I mean, if you've ever been to a sporting event too, mm-hmm. it's like if you have a mass of a couple thousand people, 30 feet away, you have no idea what's going on. Right. So yeah, I totally think that's plausible. And I think it's obviously true that there are many, many people that had no idea. Quick question for you. Do you have any idea what percentage of people took pleas versus actually challenged this all the way to the end? Because as you know, during Biden's, I don't know what speech it was, but it was relatively recent. He was bragging about, 800 something people, yeah. 900 years in prison or some crazy number. I forget what it was. Do you know what percentage of people are taking pleas versus actually trying this?
You know, I actually, about once a month, I read the updates on what the actual numbers are in terms of numbers of arrests for violence versus the misdemeanor defendants, the numbers that have been have chosen either jury trials or bench trials, the numbers that have taken plea deals. The vast majority have taken plea deals. And you understand that you can understand that they want to try to, you know, get this thing over with and then go back home and try to rebuild their lives after whatever it is that they lost. I'm in a very unique situation in that, you know, Blaze Media has been incredibly supportive of me. They did not fire me when I got charged and arrested. They doubled down. They not only brought me, I was originally working for them as a, what they call a contributing writer. And then after my threat, or after we were told that in fact they were going to charge me back in mid-December of last year, they doubled down and made me a full-time employee as a investigative, you know, correspondent for them. And then,
man, we need more media companies like the Blaze right now. Today's episode of Liberty Lockdown is once again brought to you by sheathunderwear.com. They just sent me a few pairs, and let me tell you, highest quality, most comfortable boxer briefs I have ever owned, and it ain't a close competition. So for 2024, step up your underwear game, graduate from holes, loose fabrics, cheap cotton briefs that bunch up, and buy the greatest underwear that's ever graced the balls of man. Sheath Underwear, the underwear of legends. Sheath can be worn as regular boxer briefs, or you can use the incredibly high-tech Sheath pouch to keep everything separated. You gotta keep them separated. Sorry, patent infringement. Sorry, Offspring. I wear these every day, and I can tell you, I don't. I wear them only when I go to the gym. The rest of the time, I'm a commando. I wear them a lot, though, because I go to the gym a lot. And the best thing that's ever existed, the website is fully stocked with different designs, winter-based layers to keep you warm, ladies' apparel, and more. Go to sheathunderwear.com, and if you use promo code LIBERTY, you're going to get 20% off. So once more, that's sheathunderwear.com, S-H-E-A-T-H, underwear.com, and use promo code LIBERTY for 20% off. And that's then, great. And then, that's great to hear.
And then after my arrest, I mean, they doubled down again. You know, I was arrested on Friday morning in Dallas, March the 1st. And then Monday morning, Glenn had me and one of my attorneys on his morning, you know, show on Blaze TV and Blaze Radio. And which he pledged his, you know, support to the very end to this process. And amazing. So, you know, it is amazing. And so rather than, you know, patting me on the back and say, hey, you know, Steve, we love you. You do great work. And when you get through this, you know, come back and give us a call and we'll, you know, see if there's still room for you here. They did the exact opposite. Yeah. They went all in. Obviously that, to say that didn't bring tears to my eyes would be a big lie. You know, it really impacted me emotionally.
It damn near brings tears to my eyes. I mean, there's so little courage in not just media, journalism, media, just honestly, broadly American society at this point. Like there's very, very little courage. There's very little willingness to self-sacrifice, to do the right thing. I cannot give high enough, you know, acclaim to Glenn Beck, the Blaze organization for standing by you and financially supporting you, morally supporting you, platforming you, giving you all the opportunities to make your case in the public eye. I think it's tremendously important. And, you know, the reason I'm so concerned about this story, and just so you understand my background, I'm libertarian as well, or I don't know if you would call yourself a libertarian, but
yeah, I'm a flaming libertarian.
All right, well, you and me both, brother. I am not a Trump supporter. I haven't voted for him either time. Mm-hmm. I don't hate the man. I certainly don't have Trump derangement syndrome or anything like that. But I'm extraordinarily concerned about the trajectory of our country. And honestly, like my biggest concern about Donald Trump is that I'm not sure that he has the gumption to do what needs to be done to save this country. And when, like, I know a lot of libertarians get mad at me when I talk like this, but like, we need a hero in this moment. Like we need someone who's willing to totally risk everything to actually do what needs to be done, which is dismantle a huge amount of the bureaucracy, completely bring the intelligence agencies to heel. I mean, you need to do, and you need to avoid World War III. You need to deal with inflation. You need to either abolish or audit the Fed. You have to do so much to try and get this country back on track. And I don't know that he's the guy. I haven't seen him be able to see through the bureaucratic morass that backed him up the first go around when it came to lockdowns and things like that, to have any faith in him moving forward. But we do need someone like that. And I guess what I'm curious, you know, particularly given what's happening with you, given that the judicial system has been weaponized against you, do you share my concern? I have to assume you do, but do you share my concern about the trajectory of things, or if you could just give kind of broad overview of where you think we're at?
Yeah, I tell you what, let me address, first of all, remind me if I don't get back to that specific question, but let me address what you said leading up to that as far as my tenuous relationship with Donald Trump himself, because I was in the 2016 election leading up to that, I was solidly hashtag never Trump. I was hashtag never Hillary as well. And I was never Trump because I didn't trust anything that he said, because he had always at some point in his career said the opposite. He had been on at least two sides, if not every side of every single issue, demonstrably, provably. And I did that on more than one occasion through multiple articles and that I wrote and, you know, Facebook debates and things of that nature.
Right.
So, you know, that was, and I created some pretty, you know, awful memes, anti-Trump memes during that, that election cycle. And then because I try to be, you know, we all think that we are, but I actually make an effort to be a fair broker. If somebody shows me something where I made a mistake, I will correct the mistake.
Same.
It's one of the reasons why I work for the Blaze. Whatever you feel about the Blaze, whatever anybody else feels about the Blaze, one thing that I respected about Glenn, for listening to him for 20 years before I was, on the payroll there, is that when it was brought to his attention that a mistake had been made in either one of his, you know, rants or diatribes or chalkboards or one of his specials or podcasts or whatever, he will correct the mistake. He will do that. And so I've always tried to do that myself, and I've corrected myself many, many times over the years. And so
I think I know where you're going with this.
In that spirit, when Trump was elected, I wiped the slate clean. I said, mm-hmm. Okay, all right. Because he never held an executive position in government before. He was never been a governor or a mayor. So we had no means by which to measure his words against his deeds. Okay. He had never been in a legislator. Same thing. We'd never been able to measure his words versus his votes. So I wiped the slate clean. And then instead of hashtag never Trump, I became hashtag good Trump, hashtag bad Trump, depending right. upon individual statements, individual bills that he signed, individual policies that he initiated, executive orders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. By the time we reached the end of his presidency, I had him at about 50-50 on my own liberty scale. Okay.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And back in 16, you know, I had no way but to assess Trump at zero, because he had been on both sides of every issue. So I had him scored at a zero. I had Hillary at about a 15%, and I had Gary Johnson at about 70%. He was not my ideal libertarian candidate by any stretch of the imagination.
Me neither.
All right. So I cast my vote for Johnson 16. As I said, I wiped the slate clean after four years of the Trump presidency. I had him at about 50-50. I had Biden at negative 15. and
that seems kind.
Yeah. And yeah, probably. And then I had an honest discussion with Spike Cohen here a few weeks ago about this. And he said he forgave me for not voting for him and Joe in 2020. And he admitted himself that there was a lot of chaos going on in the Libertarian Party at the time. And I felt like that I needed to cast a vote to block. And yeah. I actually, when I wrote my story and I admitted to my following at the time that I was going to actually vote for Trump this time, the photo or the screenshot that I used as the you know, for the cover of my story was a picture of the old Hollywood Squares television game show. And I just, I literally said, I'll take Trump to block. Now that's not a ringing endorsement, right?
No,
but it was exactly where my mindset was at the time, because I knew what was coming with the Biden administration. I knew that it was the third term of the Obama administration. And with all that that brought with it, which was, of course, Obama's promise to fundamentally transform this country, which he had begun laying all the groundwork for during his 8 years. And I knew that Biden was going to continue that process unfettered, especially since he was not going to have, since he was going to have a compliant Congress, you know, during his first couple of years as well. So I went that route with Trump then. And I don't, I have no regrets about that. I still am demonstrably, I unlike you, well, you said you don't hate the man. I still don't like him, but I, at this point in 2024, I am at the exact same place that I was in 2020, is that, right. Is that we have got to remove Biden from office. Now, I look, being a libertarian, I know all the arguments, and I know that, you know, the they're going to
lesser of two evils.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. They're going to come back. And in your comment section here below this video, where it's going to be posted, they're going to be throwing the thing. Yeah. It's because of guys like you that we can't break past the 1% club and getting the 1% of the vote every single time.
Right.
You know, and we will be, I will be blamed for that. I'm sorry, but I have a saying, and it goes like this. This is my life axiom. It's the axiom of my blog for years and years and years and years. I used to call myself the pragmatic libertarian, and then I changed that after it was actually right after COVID came to town. Mm-hmm. I changed it to the pragmatic constitutionalist. I just got tired of being associated with any party whatsoever. And even though I wasn't a member of any party, I wasn't even a member of the Libertarian Party, I was obviously being directly associated with the party because it was in my name, you know, sure. my branding at the time. And so I, but my axiom is this, it's there's the world we want versus the world in which we actually live. All right. Yes. I would love the Libertarian Party savior to ride in on the white horse with the sword, you know, coming out of his mouth and fire in his eyes. You know, I'm trying to get as biblical and revelation as I can, you know, with that,
We may be living through that, so that's appropriate.
Yeah, and so that's what I want. I don't see that person coming, but at least, and I do not see Trump as a savior. I do not see him as the guy riding in on the white horse. He is certainly a disruptor.
Yes,
and I like that a lot. I don't like the fact that he has never met a spending bill that he wouldn't sign, and for many other things, which is why I had him at 50-50. I'd have probably had him at, you know, 70% by the end of his term if he had not mishandled COVID. So, you know,
I agree. Yeah. I would have almost certainly supported him had that not happened.
Mm-hmm. And so there's my long answer to set up the answer to your actual question, which was, where do you see us? Or where do I see where we're at right now?
Right.
I see us on the absolute precipice of the end of our republic right now. Yeah. And I've never, ever felt that way until the COVID thing began. And I went from being a largely optimistic person with regards to the future of this country and politically and every other way to descending into, you know, I don't even think pessimism is adequately describes it. It is maybe fatalism. And that's kind of where I'm at right now. That's what I see. If we don't do something to slow down this descent into the abyss of authoritarianism, communism. Yeah. I mean, we look, people throw these terms around, you know, neo-Marxist, fascist, blah, 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 blah. Our institutions right now are led by, guided by, and controlled by communists. That's who they are. Now, they administrate that in varying forms because they do have limitations on them right now. It's like what Obama said, that the Bill of Rights is a negative, you know, set of rights. The Bill of Rights prevents government from doing the quote unquote good things that he wanted to do. Yes, exactly, sir. That's exactly what it was designed for, was to stop you from doing the things that you want to do. Slow down that progress.
Ketanji Brown Jackson, she made that point just last month. I mean, it's unbelievable. They bring up the Constitution or the Bill of Rights in particular, and they say what we say, but they say it as a negative. We say it as a positive. It's like, this is the shit y'all ain't supposed to, you can't do it. None of it. You can't do any of it. And they're like, these are all hindrances. These are hurdles. During a crisis, we have to have these powers. Otherwise, God forbid. It's like, no. If these rules don't apply during a crisis, then these rules don't apply because the crisis will be perennial. Right. And I'm very, like, I completely share your fatalism. For those in my audience, they're already well familiar, but I started this show called Liberty Lockdown 1 month into lockdowns. I went from, as same as you, quite optimistic about, you know, despite the fact that I knew that financially we were in a lot of trouble, national debt and everything like that. I knew we would have major issues at some point in my lifetime. And then it just became like all of my gravest concerns about the future that were 30 and 40 and 50 years out, mm-hmm. all became a decade or less out. It just slid everything towards me. Like the table got tilted and all of my worst nightmares got closer to me. It's honestly, that's how I feel about it. And I haven't changed. And in fact, it feels as if it's getting closer. I mean, the World War III concerns are enormous right now. Like, what Biden is doing by both arming one side of a war and sending aid to the victims of the bombing campaigns. I mean, it's crazy. The Russia-Ukraine issues with the State Department that, once again, Biden, while he was vice president, was largely responsible in fomenting so much of Russia's concerns there. It's like, this is like the people, Antony Blinken, these people are possessed. Like, yeah. I'm not even religious and I feel like they're possessed by demons. Like they have no limit to the insanity that they're willing to perpetrate. And for the life of me, I can't even really wrap my head around what the goal is. Like just out of curiosity, I know this may not be in your wheelhouse, but what do you think they're doing? I know that it's the neoliberal world order, defending the petrodollar. There's lots of theses mm-hmm. as to what's transpiring. Why are they willing to risk World War III to defend borders while our borders remain wide open?
World War III is good for them. It's good for the elite. Right. It's beneficial to their ultimate goal and ultimate agenda to bring about a new world order or a one world government or all those old, you know, catchphrases that I grew up with. I mean, I've been hearing and reading the phrase one world government since I was a kid,
right?
And fearing that, you know, the specter of that. But again, I never thought that would happen in my lifetime. then we started hearing the phrase new world order. I think it was George Bush the first that, you yep. know, dropped that one on us. And then we fast forward to what we're hearing today, the Great Reset, and
or the liberal world order, or the rules-based international order. They've got a lot of different branding on it.
Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't matter how they brand it. It's just listen to what they say after that. Whatever brand they put on it, or even, you know, regardless of how they try to obscure it rhetorically, ultimately, at the end of the day, they're telling us what they're going to do. They're telling us what they want to do. They're telling us what the vision is. And the only way to bring us over the edge and get enough of the world's population to consent to that is to create chaos beyond a level of our ability to accept, survive, feel safe. And then once they get us to that point, then they can implement all of the strategies that they have on, you know, the books for that new world that they're talking about. And look, they don't hide it. They used to, and of course it used to be so fringe that to read one of their books or to talk about it or to make a speech about it or to discuss it, even in quiet, polite company, you were a conspiracy theorist.
No, you were anymore. Not anymore. you were a bircher. Those were the primary people that were talking about it back then, or the libertarians to some extent. But I agree with you. It does feel as if the mask has been lifted, or the mask has dropped, whichever angle you prefer on the metaphor. What I don't understand is, like, you already have, not you, but I'm just saying, like, these people already have access, like, they already have control over the money supply. Yeah. You know, like imagine that, being in that position of power and being willing to jeopardize your seat at the throne for additional power. Like, that to me, I mean, just screams psychopathy. You know, like, I already have I have the strongest military on earth. I have the printing press. I have everything. I have the media largely under my thumb. You have so much and you want more. And it's just like, I honestly, and maybe this is my eternal optimist side shining through, but I just feel like they're going to fail. My concern is that in that failure, do we all die? You know, like, because I don't think they're going to prevail. I don't think that human beings broadly will accept complete servitude for all eternity. So assuming I'm right about human nature, there will be, you know, uprisings and things and different, I mean, you're already seeing it in some parts of the world. So
I believe that until the COVID lockdowns.
Yeah, I understand that. And, I understand that too.
And when I saw such a high percentage of conservative and libertarian America yield, comply, get in line, bend the knee, stretch out the arm, take the shot, put the mask on, stay home from their jobs,
isolate their children.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm pretty good with the math, and I had COVID figured out fairly well early on, just by the numbers, not the same. I just ran the numbers, and I knew that it was an overblown fatality rate that the media was foisting on us. I knew that they were lying early on. And then my own math was actually being confirmed by researchers at Stanford, University of Stockholm, UCLA.
Kolder, Bhattacharya. I know the names even.
Right. And these are actual epidemiologists. That's their job. And they use much more dramatic and difficult equations to come up with their numbers. But I was coming up with the exact same numbers that they were coming up using nothing more than fifth grade long division. and the ultimate effect that had on me was seeing how willing people were to trade their liberty for some sense of false security and safety. And that's what worries me most, is that, and this goes back to your question about what, you know, these World War III, is that's why World War III is a very, very good option for them. They know what populaces and on grand scales are willing to give up, sacrifice in the way of liberty for perceived safety and security.
Today's episode is once again brought to you by our friends over at Phoenix Ammunition. Phoenix Ammo is the greatest ammunition company in all the land. There's the graphic. PhoenixAmmo.com. You don't need any promo code or discount code, because they already give you a discount when you buy in bulk. And since I'm talking to Steve Baker right now, you probably know why you need to be buying in bulk, because this is a disaster. The whole friggin' world's melting down. So best you can do is defend your family. That's a good idea. PhoenixAmmo.com, or you can follow them on X or Twitter at Phoenix Ammo. They are shit posters. They are savages. They are just the greatest people I've ever encountered. Truly. PhoenixAmmo.com. Get you some.
Under those, you know, horrible oppressions that come with a world war. And, you know, it's trite when people say that, 1984 Orwell's book was not, you know, intended to be instruction manual. But that's what we're looking at right now. And they don't care. They don't care that we know that. Doesn't matter, because they've seen the end game. They've seen what they can accomplish. If in fact COVID was a test run, they're still running all the scenarios. They're running all the numbers. And since we're not talking about me and my arrest and my misdemeanors right now, I don't mind going wherever you want to go with this, but I will tell you right now, there's only one thing right now that is preventing the total worldwide implementation of the Great Reset. You want to guess what it is?
Either Second Amendment or independent media. I don't know. Where are you
going? Second Amendment. You nailed it. You first thing out of your mouth. Second Amendment is the big, and I'm not talking about here. I have had, because you know, the years and years and years that I've had my blog out there, during the tens of thousands of followers I've had all over the world, whether it's coming from New Zealand, Australia, Russia, Czechoslovakia, China, Taiwan, whatever, people that followed my blog for years. When I've written that and made that statement, that the only thing protecting the liberties in Taiwan and the only thing protecting the liberties that remain in Australia is our Second Amendment. You know what they write me back? They say, you're absolutely right.
Interesting. Because
when we fall here, it's over with.
Yep. I don't disagree. But see, here's the thing. You're coming off as more of a doomer than me. And yet you are still not taking a plea. You are still fighting. So if you're going to continue to fight, that implies that you have some level of hope.
I have to have hope. I mean, I have to have, because I have my children are adults, and I've stated this before in other interviews and newspaper articles and things of that nature, is that at the end of the day, there's only two people on this planet that I give a shit what they care about me, what they say about me, how they feel about me. And that's the two people that I brought into this world. They are only on this planet because of me, right? And that's the two people that I care the most about. And I feel an obligation to do everything in my power to leave them a place on this planet where they can enjoy the liberties that I've enjoyed for 60 years. And that's my motivating. That's my motivating factor. Now, since we're shifting back over to me again, all right, and my circumstance and my situation, this idea of not taking a plea deal and getting this over with, you know, we talked about earlier, I'm very fortunate. I didn't lose my job through this process.
Right.
I've not had my bank accounts canceled. I have not even had my Facebook page canceled, which is what they do to all January 6th defendants. They cancel your Facebook page. And the reason why, and a lot of people, you know, they're suspicious of me. I read all the nonsense on X and elsewhere.
This guy still has his Facebook. He must be a Fed.
I'm a Fed. I'm controlled opposition. Right. I'm working behind the scenes with DOJ, FBI, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that all of this work that I'm doing, uncovering corruption, that's just the little bits of stuff and that they're feeding me and that they're willing to acquiesce to, you know? And, I see all that and I read all that, but there's a reason why that the Department of Justice has treated me with kid gloves for 3 years. And it's because I have a larger voice than anybody else that they have arrested up to this point. That's it. Yep. And they know that whatever they do, each time they color outside of the lines, we're going to put millions of eyeballs on it.
Right.
And they're going to have to deal with the black eye, with the PR, you know, ramifications of that. And so they are even, what is today? Friday. So Wednesday was my actual arraignment. That's where I had to, you know, I had to plead guilty, not guilty or whatever. And obviously I pled not guilty to all four charges. And then there was discussions about my pretrial restrictions and, you know, because I'm released, you know, I'm not held in confinement before my trial. And there's a certain list of restrictions. One of the things I had to do was I had to give up my guns while I'm being held in pretrial, to whatever extent of liberty I have right now. And so I had to give up my guns. The pretrial services officer came by my house on Monday morning, checked my safe. It's empty. I've removed them. I've taken them elsewhere. They didn't confiscate them, but I had to move them out of my place of residence. So they verified all of that. But I have less pretrial restrictions on me than any other January 6th defendant. I have no restrictions on my movement. I can travel. I can even go across state lines without permission. I can travel into the District of Columbia without permission.
Wow.
I can travel internationally without permission.
Wow, you sound like a real threat to the establishment. I don't know why are they throwing the book at you?
Well, I mean, it's everything I just said to you right there is proof that I'm a Fed, obviously. And this is a battle that they didn't want to have. It was a battle my attorneys wanted. My attorneys wanted them to try and put a restriction for me going into DC, because that's where I do a tremendous amount of my work is right there. And so they wanted that battle. They wanted to make that a big, big part of my case. And the government, in their own perverted wisdom, figured that out at their own, you know, a star chamber, conference table. They figured out, no, let's not do this one. You know, let's not fight that battle. And so as far as the other restrictions that I have on me, we're actually going to be filing motions to have those lifted as well, because there's only two reasons. There's only two reasons that there's pretrial restrictions for defendants that are not detained pretrial. There's only two reasons. And this is the government's reasons. First one, are you a flight risk? Right. Well, they apparently have already acknowledged that I must not be a flight risk because they're not even keeping me from traveling international. All right. Second is that you're a danger to society. Okay. I have no criminal record whatsoever. I have no history of violence whatsoever. I have no history of improper use of my guns whatsoever in my entire life. Never had an assault charge, even after, you know, having a few too many drinks in a bar one. And that's never happened to me. I'm just not predisposed to that. I didn't throw myself into violence on January 6th. I don't even have any such charge related to that at all. So my attorneys intend on making the government prove why I can't have my guns. Because as a misdemeanor defendant, this is very interesting. As a misdemeanor defendant, if I'm found guilty on all four charges, guess what I get back the next day?
Your guns.
My guns.
Well, this is so crazy. What, like, so given that they're treating you better than most defendants in a similar situation, granted, not as well as the New York Times reporters who haven't even got charges at all, but right. You know, everybody else that's received charges, why not just drop the charges against you? Like, it seems like this is such a losing battle for them. PR, I'm not even sure that they could win in court. Like, it all seems like, what are they doing?
Well, they do in fact know they're going to win in court. It's a 99.75% conviction rate right now in January 6th cases. Yeah. So they're going to win. And if I take this battle, I understand going in that I'm going to lose. There's only been two outright acquittals of all the cases so far that have been adjudicated, January 6th defendants. And those were both bench trials. A jury has not fully acquitted everyone yet, but you know, some juries have, if you had seven or eight charges against you, they may have found you, you know, not guilty on four of the charges, but still acquitted you on the other four. I found you guilty on the other four. And so the point being is that there is the expectation that if I go into this, that I'm going into this with the risk, the very high likelihood of risk that I'm going to lose, and that there are people, because of the work that I've been doing, are desperate to see me punished severely. And so we have, I won't get into the details of the two cases, but there's two other independent journalists. I've covered their trials extensively. One of them, 100% professional behavior, didn't do anything wrong. No picketing, no parading. His only sin, his only crime was that he was an activist in the Latinos for Trump movement before he went to DC, but he was actually contracted by a mainstream local television station in Mobile, Alabama. He had the big professional rig. He wasn't walking around filming with his cell phone. He showed up with his professional, very expensive gear. And when he was convicted of the four misdemeanors, oh, by the way, swatted by over 20 agents,
Jesus,
red dots on his entire family at 6:30 in the morning. He decided that he was not going to plead guilty to something he did not do. He was where they're working as a journalist, and you weren't arresting other journalists. So I'm going to go to trial. I'm going to do that. He opted for a bench trial. The judge found him guilty on all four misdemeanors and then threw him in prison for 8 months. First 2 months in solitary confinement.
Wow.
When he got into the general population, a medium security prison in Georgia, he learned that he was the only misdemeanor defendant in that prison. And that in fact, no misdemeanor defendants go to that prison.
Wow.
Unless you're a January 6th guy. Okay. Then on the other hand, there's another young independent journalist. He got charged with the same four basic misdemeanors, behaved himself appropriately while he was in the Capitol. His crime and his sin is that at one point while he was in the Capitol, he joined in the chant and three times said, USA, USA, USA. Therefore, he was part of the mob.
Right.
And despite the fact that he had in his dossier press credentials going all the way back to when he was 16 years old, the judge would not allow the jury, and he opted for a jury trial. The judge would not allow the jury to see his dossier of historical coverage of other events and the press credentials he had acquired to do that.
On what grounds?
They were trying to present a selective prosecution argument, and the judge heard the motion pre-trial and said, no, can't do it. What grounds? You tell me. Yeah. Oh, and by the way, this was
are railroading.
Yeah, this was a Trump-appointed judge. But
what the fuck?
Same four misdemeanors. All right. Now, the other guy, he got 8 months in prison. The judge had mercy on this guy in his sentencing. I was there, you know, I was covering his trial. And the judge had mercy on him and just said, hey, you know, just because you think you're covering an event, that doesn't give you permission to go through a restricted space. And he let him off with 1 year probation and a $2,000 fine, 100 hours of community service, and sent him home. So here you have two starkly similar, you know,
right,
cases. One guy gets 8 months in a medium security prison. He's, you know, having to go back home now and rebuild his life. Thankfully, he had a great family and wife and supportive family, and he's doing fine. He's out now. And the other kid, he got off, you know, with a probation, but both of them have the federal convictions on their records now.
What a disaster, man.
Yeah.
So I guess it seems as if you've accepted your fate that you're not going to prevail in court. Am I reading that correctly?
I'm certainly going to play to win.
Okay, good.
Oh yeah. Oh, call me. No, they're going to have to work harder on this case than any case they have adjudicated so far. We're going to put them through the ringer in a way in which they've never been put through the ringer before. The one thing that has already happened in my case is that even though I am not, one of the Oath Keepers or one of the Proud Boys, you know, the Oath Keepers trial, the first one was 9 weeks long. I was there in the courtroom every single day covering that trial. The Proud Boys case was like 5 months long. It was crazy. And though the left wing media covered those two cases, the right wing media didn't cover them at all. I was sitting there in the court, in the media room, the press pool, every day for 9 weeks in the Oath Keepers trial. And there was just myself and one young cub reporter from Epoch Times. Their office is literally one block from the courthouse there in DC. So she was there, and she did a great job just, you know, writing her little 600, 800 word story every single day. And me, an independent blogger, in there tweet storming live from the courthouse every day. And that was it. Fox, their studio is two blocks away. They weren't there. Newsmax wasn't there. They're in DC. Reason Magazine, they weren't there. I can go down the list. None of them. Blaze wasn't there. Blaze doesn't have an operation in DC, but they weren't there.
Sure.
So I was angry during that time that I was left alone with my blog to try and tell the other side of what was happening. because the mainstream press was doing what the mainstream press does. You know, they were accounting what they deemed to be the most significant events and testimonies in that trial, but they were leaving out half of those testimonies. They were leaving out the cross examinations by the defense. They were leaving out, it wasn't that they were lying or saying anything wrong. It was just typical lies of omission.
Right.
Is what we were getting from the mainstream press during that trial. And no big loud voice, big right wing bullhorn was there to let America know this is not exactly the way it happened.
Sure.
Not exactly the way the New York Times told you that it happened today.
Out of curiosity, I mean, these stories matter to a big chunk of, you know, readers, the electorate, whatever you want to call it. Why is it that the conservative media is essentially turning a blind eye? I mean, do you have any thesis?
I think I've got beyond thesis.
All right. Okay. Then give me the facts.
Yeah. First of all, it's absolutely demonstrably true that the vast majority of GOP legislators do not want to touch January 6th. They understand, rightfully so, that it's the biggest bruise they ever got. It's the biggest whipping they've ever taken in terms of narrative in the history of the country. The actions of only about 300 people, that's key. We're not talking about tens of thousands of people. It was not the actions of hundreds of thousands of people. It was the actions of about 300 people shaped and handed up on a silver platter to Nancy Pelosi the narrative that the left has been feasting off of for the last 3 years. And most of the GOP legislators have no taste for countering it whatsoever. There's only a handful of guys fighting the fight behind the scenes to try and correct the narrative. And then the same thing is true on the right-wing media side of things. Fox, you know, once they got rid of Tucker, that's it. They're done with January 6th. They have no taste for it whatsoever. Daily Wire has no taste for it whatsoever. And, you know, that's a big part of the right-wing media, you know, sphere is Daily Wire. And they have no interest in January 6th stories whatsoever.
Because I assume it's because it would put you in the classification of being a real opposition, a real dissident publication that would ultimately run afoul of the regime, and they fear the regime.
It's either that or they have just accepted defeat on it. Let's move past it. You know, Governor DeSantis, who I've spoken with about this, he famously said that when asked about January 6th, he said, "That's the past. We're looking forward to the future."
Well, it isn't the past for the people that are languishing in prison, Ron.
No, that's exactly right. And I got about 15 minutes privately, one-on-one with the governor. And I said, "With all due respect, sir, you do not understand. This is now. This is the here and now." Yeah. And it's not just the here and now for those, you know, people languishing in prison. It's the here and now because of what's happening in these cases. Until you understand that every single one of these cases are eviscerating the First Amendment, because right, that's what it boils down to, is that people are being punished for their voice. Innocent people who did nothing more than take a selfie and chant USA, sing the national anthem, "Whose house, our house, stop the steal, stop the steal." Whether you agree with any of those sentiments at all, that's not the point. That's what they're being punished for. And in fact, and this is what I explained to the governor, and I also explained it to Jim Jordan in a one-on-one. I also explained it to Speaker Johnson in a one-on-one conversation, is that until you understand that if you're a young couple or a grandmother that walked into the Capitol for 10 minutes and you held up a cell phone and you took a couple selfies, you probably got a slap on the wrist. You got a plea deal, 2 years probation, $2,000 fine, $500, you know, or 100 hours of community service. And that's because you didn't say anything. But if you walked into the Capitol for 10 minutes and you took a selfie and you go, "Hey, look at us. We just stormed the Capitol." Oh.
Yeah.
Oops.
Yeah.
Guess what happened to you? 2 months years in prison, 6 months, 8 months in prison.
Yeah. What a nightmare. I mean, this is so crazy.
But see, that's what they're going after me for is words that I said before I arrived at the Capitol and words that I said after the Capitol in jest. I'm sitting in the hotel room that night with a colleague, a writer, very successful writer, who we're having drinks, and I'm, you know, we're watching the news, and we'd just seen, you know, the reports coming, you know, coming out that afternoon that somebody had stolen Nancy Pelosi's laptop. And I recounted walking into the hallway where the speaker's offices were. And when I said this on the video, that as soon as I saw that there had been, you know, damage, property damage, that people were overturning furniture and things of that nature in her office, I got the hell out of there. Mm-hmm. Like, no, don't want any part of this. But I also said two things that they are in my charging documents. I said, now I'm sitting in a hotel room in Virginia, right? I'm off campus. I'm not in a restricted space. I can say whatever the hell I want at this point, according to the First Amendment. And I said about her overturned furniture, I said, yeah, it couldn't have happened to a more deserving bitch. Okay. To which most people have said to me, and you're wrong. Why?
Yeah, exactly.
And then when the FBI asked me that in my interview, why did you say that? I said, because I wasn't in McConnell's office. And they And I said, if I'd have been in McConnell's office, I would have said it couldn't have happened to a more deserving bastard. And I followed that up in my FBI interview by saying, what part of me being a libertarian and hating both sides do you not yet understand?
Oh, man, you are my people.
And then I went on. So, got an adult beverage in my hand, and we're joking. And I said, you know what my biggest regret is? That I wasn't the one that stole, you know, Nancy Pelosi's laptop. Can you imagine what we would have discovered about the government if I had taken her laptop?
Yeah, a real journalist.
So I'm joking about this with an adult beverage in my hand, not on Capitol property in Virginia. And
right.
It's in my charging documents.
Yeah. They're trying to frame it as like actual desire, intent, planning, whatever.
State of mind, all of that.
Yeah. Goodness gracious, man. Well, look, I really appreciate that you're willing to go to the mat to fight this thing. As you know, the vast majority of people take pleas. And also, as you know, and you've already said, that's all precedent. That's all, you know, case law that will be used to essentially further degrade the First Amendment, press rights, free speech, right to protest, you know, right to peacefully assemble, all that. So this is really important, and it's really bigger than any one of us, but I know that it is the individual that has to take that fight on, and you've chosen to do it. I want to give huge applause to the Blaze for standing by you, and I will continue to cover this story and provide updates, and I hope that the Dan Bonginos of the world and the Tucker Carlsons of the world and the Joe Rogans of the world all come to your maybe not defense, but at least boost the message so that people understand what's happening. If you could just, as we wrap up, if you could just say, you know, what is the timeline for resolution of all this, and is there anything people can do to assist?
Right now, my case is on. It's where, you know, as I said, I had my arraignment this week. My next, what they call status hearing, is not for 2 months. That's in early June. In between now and June, there'll be motions filed, all types of motions filed from the defense team. There'll be responses from the government. There'll be rulings from the judge about what can be presented. Then we start getting into discovery, and my case is so bizarre that even the judge on Wednesday, he was like, what does he do for a living? He didn't even know. And my attorney goes, well, he's a journalist for Blaze Media. And the judge was clearly caught off guard by that, because the prosecution and the defense teams were talking about some negotiations that they were, you know, they were engaged in and favorably and congenially engaged in with regards to the fact that, like with discovery, the fact that I've already had access to the 41,000 hours worth of, you know, Capitol CCTV video. I've had more access than any other journalist that I know to that. And I'm going to be back in there 2 weeks. I'll be back in the room again, viewing video there. And so I've already seen, and I've already used video that was under court seal, under the protective order, that was not supposed to be released to the public, but I got permission from Congress. Wow. Separation of power. So even though judiciary or DOJ that, so that DOJ is actually under the executive branch. So even though DOJ doesn't want these things to be released, and even though judiciary, the judges, don't want some of these videos to be released, Congress is giving them to me to release. They can't stop that from happening.
Wow.
And
that's amazing.
So my trial discovery issues are much more complicated than any other January 6th trial so far. Mm-hmm. So the judge was like, what? And so so it's going to be a lot of getting up to speed on his part. And as I said, there's going to be a lot of back and forth, laying the parameters, the ground rules, or ignoring them in my case, or whatever the case may be. So it's going to be very, very different for all parties than any of the other J6 cases so far. So it begins. As I said, my next status hearing is in 2 months, and I don't see any way that this is going to go to trial before the election.
So this will be a years long endeavor.
Oh yeah, I mean it's basically however long we want to make it, because we can push this thing off with all manner of legal procedures, but I don't want it to go over forever.
I'm sure you'd like to move on with your life at some point.
Yeah. This is not what I want to be focused on for the next year or 2 years of my life. And then as far as what can be done to help, I don't have one of these, fundraisers, Gibson Go or such as that for my legal fees, because I've been very blessed in that regard. I have 5 attorneys working with me right now, probably will be 1 or 2 more added to my team before we get to the finish line. And all of them are working pro bono because they believe in this case. They believe they understand the implications for the country, for the First Amendment, for Bill of Rights as a whole. And they want to be part of this fight, and they've pledged themselves to me through this whole process voluntarily. So I'm blessed in that. And I just
got chills that to see attorneys actually do something for the right reason. I'm like, yes, there's still decent human beings on this planet. Thank goodness.
Yeah, I mean I think it was the Monday after my arrest, Glenn had Alan Dershowitz on, and they were talking about my case. And Glenn asked him, he says, well, what would it cost me to hire you to represent Steve? And Glenn's and Alan Dershowitz, the most famous lawyer in America, he goes, oh, I'll take it pro bono.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. They see the implications of this case.
Yeah.
And so I don't need that. I mean, obviously there are other expenses that are not being covered outside of my own, my paycheck. And so I still have my blog, and I use the Locals platform. And so anybody that can and is willing to help me there, wants to follow there, get more insider information, because it's free to subscribe. So you can go sign in as a follower of my page there. And you can just go to TPC, the number 4 USA. So TPC4USA.com. That's it. And perfect. That'll take you straight to my Locals blog. And so you can either get a free subscription, or you can become a supporter, supporting subscriber. And for as little as $5 a month, you can do that. You can make one-time donations there, whatever the case you want to do. And then for the subscribers, I do 2 or 3 or 4 weekly updates behind the scenes about what's happening with my case, other things, little insider, clues and to some of the investigations I'm working on, stuff like that I put behind the paywall. And so there is a benefit, to being a subscriber that I try to make sure happens. And then of course my social media handle everywhere is TPC4USA, whether perfect. It's or Facebook. And then the most important thing to follow our actual stories. And there's a big one that came out last night on The Blaze, is they've actually given me my own URL there. So it's theblaze.com/truth. And that's where all of my stories go on that URL. Oh, theblaze.com/truth. And you can follow all of that there.
I love it. Well, Well, you're following him over at Locals. Follow me, Liberty Lockdown, at local or .locals.com.
There you go.
Thank you so much, Steve. Sincerely, I hope that you trounce these motherfuckers. I'm just gonna say it how I actually feel. Man, this is really, really important. And as you said, you know, the deck is stacked against you, the odds are stacked against you, but you know, for the hope of, you know, liberty, justice, this country, I think that your case matters a tremendous amount. And, you know, anything I can do to help, please do let me know.
Hey, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me today.
If anybody, you know, wants to support my work, you can subscribe on X at Liberty Lock Pod. And please do hit the like button, leave a comment down below, and share this. This will not be favored by the algorithms. I can assure you of that. So the only way people are going to even know that it exists is if you, you know, share it around on your social medias. Thank you again, Steve.
Thank you, Clint.
Welcome to Liberty Lockdown. Please scan your barcode. Your liberty ain't gone, but yeah, it's on hold. Where did it come from and where did it go?